gonna start running.
So this title, I had something else, and then he came up with this, and I feel that there's a joke here that everyone else is getting, because he said compliment me on the title, and I actually don't get it. So if you want to actually explain it better later.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I'll pass on that.
Okay.
So one quick point of order is that we're not actually talking about evergreen content. I think one of the slides references the practice of evergreen
content.
It's all related. But it is ultimately all related. So yes, welcome. We're going to talk about archiving practices. Michael, if you want to introduce yourself.
Patience. Good one.
Wait for him. Does anyone in the room know how to work a slideshow?
You have to click the little icon that says next. It has the tiny preview.
Thank you. Yep. The arrow buttons were working here.
Yep, that's right.
Now we can say hello. Next.
I'm just going to keep pressing arrow buttons to work.
So my name is Michael Donohue. I used to work at the New York Times for a few years on various things, and I worked at Quartz, and now I'm at the New Yorker, which is owned by Condé Nast. And, you know, that is covering, you know, the New York Times is 100 and something years worth of content. Quartz was the opposite, where it was 0 days of content. And now we're back at the New Yorker, where we just hit 91 years worth of content. So this is a bit of a, you know, my experience and other people's experience, whom I've spoken to, kind of like pulling into some of the things, some of the concepts we're gonna discuss today. And that, well, Matt hasn't really done much, but that's okay.
Now I'm new here. So I'm Matt, VP Product over at Pitchfork. Can everyone generally hear me? Just get that away. Over at Pitchfork, we're kind of nestled right in between where we've been around for 20 years and our archives go back almost that far. We've suffered some.
I can't believe it's been 20 years.
No. we have suffered some data loss over time. About 7 years ago, we whipped the site into shape when the company got very serious about development and design and taking themselves as more than just like a site on the internet where you dump text.
But we also know that a lot of people here are also from media companies, from libraries, from other things. And we were going to do this exercise as part of a survey where we actually move everyone around, but people have laptops out and coffee, we're not going to do that. But what I would like to do is get a show of hands for people who, basically, if you work with an archive or similar that is less than 5 years old, could you raise your hands, please? Okay, I think it's like 1 or 2, 3.
It doesn't matter if you're a company that has several properties like Fox. I mean, any place where you might have like either a small repository of content.
Okay, and if you're in that like 5 year to 10 year worth of archives,
20
give or take.
Okay.
Okay, and who goes like into decades? Like, okay, and bonus round, anyone with more than like 90 or 100 years worth of data? Can you tell me?
Times.
The Atlantic. Got it. Okay. So what I would like to, as part of this as well, like if we're probably going to see some things which are very unique to archives that go back really far, and as opposed to really new and in between. But I'd really like to see like the patterns that are common to all three. So we may bring this up again as we go through it. There's a, you know, when you're starting from scratch, you don't have to worry about a lot of legacy. But I think once you get beyond a certain threshold of years, I don't know what that number is, some interesting problems kind of begin to emerge.
Before we move on, I do want to ask one more question on the survey side. Is anyone here not from like a traditional media publisher or anyone in like data collection, places like that? Okay, cool. What kind of places are you from?
BuzzFeed,
okay.
Independent artists I've worked with, museums, archives, and things like that.
Awesome, fantastic, very cool.
I just stumbled in off the street.
Welcome.
Could someone score them out, please?
I'm in academia now, so I'm working on a project with those people.
Oh, very nice, okay. Cool, yeah, let's move on. So this is kind of what we really want to talk about today. What do everyone's archives look like? Everyone's archives are always in different shapes and forms. We'll talk more about that later, but I think generally we wanted to take a look at how we've done it, both at, of course, New York Times, New Yorker, Pitchfork, and then open to everyone else, talk about some things we've identified, things that maybe you guys have identified too, common practices, best practices, things like that.
And we had this idea that we're going to go through like 8 different sections in depth, but then we realized we only had 1 hour. Mm-hmm. And we also did not want this to be us dictating a format and just telling you things. We're going to try and open this up as much as possible. So we came up with some high-level themes that we're going to touch upon, some more in-depth than others. Others are very much more practical and technical. Others really depend on editorial and workflow. And then depending on any kind of feedback we get along the way, we will, again, we will kind of like sidestep some in favor of others if that's what is of more interest.
Yeah, I know that we have the microphones, but if you guys ever wanted to stand up, come up here, take a microphone, please, by all means, don't be afraid to shout anything out. We don't have to stick on this topic or this list of topics exactly. Tangents are welcome, relatively speaking. I guess before we dive into the first point, can we get a volunteer? Anyone?
For what?
All right. Do you mind standing up? Okay. Moving on. So, Organization of Archives,
please make yourself comfortable and sit. We were hoping it was one of our friends that we were going to pick on, but he did not actually take it.
I took it, eh? I'm a sucker.
What's that? So first question. Organization of Archives, complete these questions, and hopefully all the notes that we have in here kind of make the topic self-evident. We didn't go out of our way to strongly define them, so we'll try and lead the discussion, but don't always have to. Where is your content? This is, I think, maybe the most atomic question.
And this is the most interesting the older you get. I want to...
Yeah.
This part is not off the record. The other stuff I will get to, that'll be off the record. But within The New Yorker, for example, we have a FileMaker Pro database with lots and lots of data. And we are actively using it, not in the way that you think, but certainly there is this kind of legacy workflow that actually still works really well. So there's a lot of data sits there. More on a more modern level, since 2014, we're using a MySQL database to store everything as part of WordPress. But there are these other kind of repositories. And I'm curious, like I kind of put it down there, but is anyone actually using, let's say, Microsoft Access or FileMaker Pro or any other kind of somewhat antiquated database? Okay, I really thought it wouldn't be just The New Yorker.
Fantastic.
Okay, well.
Quick survey of the room. Who is using MySQL or Postgres? Okay. Generally like it. Probably works pretty well. Who's using something that's not that, but it's still like a SQL-oriented database? Yeah, cool. Who has a wide variety of collections and disparate resources that they have to organize? Awesome. Just shout out, I guess, where are you guys keeping it? How are you collecting all of this?
Refrigerator.
Okay.
Has anyone actually recently moved off a really bizarre, archaic system to something more modern? Yeah?
Well, not so much, so I work at the Post, but not for that part of my job. I also am part of something called the California State Data Coalition, where we're trying to like make California's campaign finance data available and easy to like access and download and analyze. And it, when they created their database, they created their own file format called .cal, and it's
dot what?
Dot cal, like C-A-L, like, which is also like a calendar format, or like iCal, I guess.
I thought you said cows, which I thought was really fascinating.
I know, cal, that would be amazing. Cal, C-A-L. And what's so funny about it is it's basically a like database file format, but it's crazy. Like, there's no software to like analyze it, right? That exists to like load it. So you gotta like try to like rough convert it into SQL or whatever. SQL table, and then when you go to read the documentation for it, there's literally like, this is like from the state of California, like you'll like look at like a documentation for like a table, and it'll be like, ask Joe. Like, I don't know who Joe is, like, does he still work for California, like this government, you know? And so that's probably really crazy. So we like ported it all over into, or we created adapters that can go to MySQL or Postgres, but it took us like not even joking, almost 2 years to figure out how to do it.
Have you moved off of that system yet?
Well, California has it, but we can now ingest that format into a format that same people can actually use.
Actually, this is off topic, but the crossword puzzle format that the New York Times uses, the .puz files, if you ever want like a long weekend of like hitting your head on a wall, try and figure out how to do that. It's not fun. Okay, so that was one subject. The other one, which I'm actually no, I'm more interested in the next one after this, so I will
punt back to right past both of the other points too.
Did I what?
That's okay.
Sorry. We did rehearse this on this.
Okay. I'll share some information about Pitchfork. So, a long time ago, universe not too far away, we had a Drupal database. Are you guys familiar with how Drupal structures its data?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No tears. The site was crashing all the time. I was working at another company. We ended up getting the job to redesign everything. The first thing we did was rebuild the database into MySQL, built a proper taxonomy, separate all the content out, tried to build like formal relationships, make it a very normalized system. The advantages we got from that now we had structured archives that you didn't have to do any funny business to find any content with, and you had all of the taxonomy sitting adjacent to the information. So if you needed to then refine based on like a single data point that is part of the greater document, that was now possible. It kind of amazed me as I talked with more people about this, how many other smaller publications at the time had never even conceived of this. You know, they grabbed like a product off the shelf and they had never kind of professionalized or done anything along the sense of building out a real system. Has anyone here entered a company in this situation and also tried to hold them back from the brink of insanity? Mm-hmm. Nice. Right. I guess our last question on this one is, how are you guys integrating your archives with your CMS? Are they the same thing? Do you have to go elsewhere to find the documents? Is everything sitting in a refrigerator? If it is, like, who has access to the refrigerator? Did you build a portal? No.
This is about to become very relevant. Over at Box Media, we're designing a new CMS, and new entries will not be compatible with the old CMS. So when we pull the plug, which is happening in a few months, there will be this permanent read-only format in, a giant grid monolithic Rails app that is no longer being maintained, but you'll have to always be able to read-only, view your articles in it.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the solution. It's like this refrigerator that's read-only that you can get content out of, but if you can't edit in there, and then if you really want to, you'll be able to port a read-only old article into the new system, but it's kind of frozen in time, and it will be maintained at a kind of bare minimum.
So there's no plan to actually just pull everything across and just have it live?
Really? Is this like text content, or is there a lot of rich multimedia inside?
Up to, I think, eight-ish years of all kinds of different content, some of which hasn't been supported for a really long time. So it'd be like a startup cost to even port a version of the oldest content.
Now, what do you think you're going to do with that content in 5 or 10 years?
The stuff that ends up getting ported because of Evergreen in some way, like version control starts to play a big part of that, because you would want to maintain the way that it was Evergreen, but maybe you want to tweak something, maybe like a joke. So you want to remember what it used to be, and maybe it'll stay published in some form, but get republished. Some of it will get republished, some of it will get updated as it is live, but then you'll have versioning on our side so you can see what it used to be.
Yeah. That's really cool. Those kinds of tools are very precious to come by too. It's amazing that you're building the infrastructure right now to actually watch how a document evolves, even if it's something you never touch again. That's fantastic.
So I work at the Atlantic, and we have web archives back to the early 90s. And we wrote a scraper that scraped all of our web content up until I think 2004. And it's all hanging out in our CMS, but there's enough articles that we can't guarantee that they'll look good, so it's searchable, and if somebody ever needs it, they can just go in, spot check it, and click publish. And then it shows up in a contemporary Atlantic format. But there's tens of thousands of articles. So.
How do people approach reformatting that? Do you have a dedicated team of web producers, or maybe anyone from editorial going back? Do you have a UI that they can see of maybe things that might be more relevant?
So for even knowing it exists, one of the nice things about working in a long-standing American magazine is that there are literally people that remember that stuff. And for reformatting it, it's mostly interns. Not that it doesn't actually require that much production though, because it's not the web in 1995 is not that complicated.
But actually, I could back up what he's saying in terms of the New Yorker. On occasion, there are stories that they will want to pull. We have a lot of famous writers who got started in the New Yorker. I think I use one as an example later, but if something's been pulled from like 1962, there are people in the organization who have the institutional knowledge who actually be able to tell you what issue that came up with just by thinking about it sometimes. So it's kind of amazing, but it's all exists in this like weird XML format that they, that we have a makeup department who actually make up the magazine every week, and they are extremely organized and efficient, and they will scrub the XML and actually kind of bring it back into readable format. The copy editors will go through it again. It's a very tedious and time-consuming process. I mean, they're able to do it on a relatively quick turnaround, but you're talking about like probably 4 days per article, and typically a long article too, so bear that in mind. Yeah, so it's good to know we're not alone, especially with the institutional knowledge side of things.
So when you're, you know, I'm also from Bridgeport, and so like all of our content existed when the internet existed, but when you have something like an article from 1962, how do you assign metadata to that, and then how do you get that into Max WordPress's, you know, tags and all that kind of stuff, or do you have sort of an external system that, how do you...
So we have a system. Yeah, so all the older data was in this thing called Library Index. One of the things that the New Yorker has is actually a dedicated library staff. It had that for decades. And so everything from when it was first started publishing in the 1920s actually has been tagged in some capacity by professional library staff. The problem with that, of course, is that there is some arbitrary kind of formats and things that were done internally in terms of keywords that were just, that those practices kept up to be for the sake of consistency. So we were recently doing a project where we were, any article with six or more tags that were consistent, we would create a tag page for that automatically, you know, just for the fun SEO benefits that we would accrue from that, because we killed our original tag pages in our last redesign. But we were finding that there was like these very strange things which were more like quotes. Some of them began with semicolons or non-alphanumeric characters. And this was like the library shorthand on the magazine side that was making its way through the workflow and eventually working into its way into WordPress, which we use to run the site. So it was, and that stuff is still there. In theory, that there's tag pages where there's quotations involved. Again, those would be like, you know, that'd be a tag page of one result. But again, it follows a kind of a somewhat archaic format. And that hasn't held us back too much, but still, it's something that you have this, you know, what the hell kind of moment when you see it, especially when there's like 320,000 tags and only maybe 50,000 of those have like five or more articles associated to the tag. There's a lot of like single hits. So we're figuring out the best way to deal with that too.
Back to you. Cool. I had a question, but I totally forgot. So. Oh, there was a question on this side of the room.
Oh.
Somebody over here had a question.
I was going to ask, who has librarians? And then you brought the
librarians. Did anyone else here, medium to large publication, have librarians, or any small publication have librarians?
Yeah, and I know the New York Times has a dedicated staff who actually manage a taxonomy, which is actually published every year. Ours is not as advanced as that. Ours are just general terms which don't have notion of location, person, place, things like that.
I mean, I work, I'm actually a librarian, but I don't do this at all in my job. And there used to be people in our organization, but you know, through cutbacks and everything, unfortunately, that's been one of the things that folks don't think about. And I'm really happy that you're here, you know, talking about that stuff. Our archives are, I work in a news organization, and our archives are all over the place. You know, we have some digital archives, what I call digital archives, which is just microfilm that's been digitized going back to the 1800s. And then we have like a text archive from the 80s to now, but the current text archive only includes those things that have been published in the newspaper. If it's been online, then you have to search a different database.
Don't get me started on that.
And so it's a pain. And I don't know if we're ever gonna solve that.
I think it's a series of small steps. To do anything drastic, there's always this element of risk and urgency behind it. I'm just mindful of time here. We're into like 20 minutes, so we may
breeze through a couple things.
We might, or but if there's anything that we think is you think is specifically interesting that we should pause on, by all means, flag us.
One of the other problems going on in Pittsburgh is that it's very hard to onboard very young people and expect them to have knowledge of bands and things that happened way before their time. In our particular world, this moves very fast, and it's not like, you know, the news in our archives are, you know, Man Lands on the Moon. It's Kanye releases his album 2 years ago or something like that, or maybe the first appearance of Drake in a section that's now gone. It's also very hard to bring social people in who may not be, or really any employees, may not be necessarily in our world. And we have to give them the kinds of tools that augment the lack of like a collective intelligence so that they can summon from our vast archives important reference points along the musical history that we've covered.
Yeah, and actually one of the other things we're finding with the New Yorker specifically is that a lot of the platforms right now require information that we just certainly did not have or would have collected 10, 5 years ago, or even on some articles. You know, if you're going to be sharing on Facebook or Twitter or any of those platforms, typically you do want images to go with that. A lot of our content doesn't have images. But fine, those things can continue to be shared. However, with some other platforms that are emerging, if you're going the route of instant articles, or even with AMP that Google's been pushing, those require images in order to be considered actual news articles. That can also go for Google News too, where it will want information as well that typically wasn't provided like 5, 10 years ago. So there's these natural barriers, unfortunately, to a lot of your older content being, you know, used without a certain level of production work, whether it's buying art, securing rights for it, and just the labor and time and cognitive, labor that goes into actually making those decisions and putting those things together.
This goes beyond allowing your people to browse and sort. What it really kind of goes back to is, in this new world on the web, third parties are starting to dictate their own constraints. All the assumptions that you made even a year ago before Facebook Instant Articles or Facebook Live or really third-party platforms, you know, undermining, I guess you could say, the open web, as it were. All those assumptions are slowly being like thrown out. Nowadays, even like revenue models are being completely flipped over because traditionally, like us are reliant not on subscriptions but on web advertising. And if web advertising is no longer compatible where we have to publish out on all these syndicated platforms like Google AMP, or we can't create the kind of experiences in direct brand sales that we're so used to doing, that are frankly like where a lot of our money comes from, what do we do? But we can't exactly not adapt because now we have strong implications if we don't, or consequences if we don't adapt to something like Google AMP. If you don't participate in Google AMP, your SEO is gonna go through the floor, you know, and suddenly for someone who relies on SEO like us, you're in trouble. Not fun.
So retrofitting, the process of going back and actually trying to selectively correct this. So there is, I don't know whether it's in this, you know, I could go into more practical examples, but we've taken major steps with the New Yorker to go in and see like what we can do for the last few years. Having like good content for the last 5 years or even the last year is more important than 40 years ago for the most part. There's the long tail of things of incoming traffic. With a few exceptions, the more recent it is, the more relevant it is. So this is not quite off the record because I have kind of like, there's nothing proprietary here. Again, I said with the New Yorker, we use WordPress. I took these screenshots today on production. I didn't want to risk losing Wi-Fi. If you go into posts, so actually a little bit of background, within the New Yorker, it's classified as an article if it originated in the magazine, and a post if it originated on the website. It's kind of an arbitrary distinction, but there are meaningful workflow implications for that. But for posts, for example, if you go in and search for iframe, you will get, where does it say it? You will get a lot of hits for iframe. Yeah,
6,000.
Thank you. Well, yeah, 1,667 items. That's a lot. It's not terrible, but when you apply that for iframes, if you remember Flash, could do copy and paste embed codes. If you were doing, you know, basically, well, actually, let me go through a few more examples rather than just speaking ahead of my slides. If we do, if we look for script tags within posts, even if we go to articles and look for iframe, it's much better actually, because really on the magazine we don't publish iframes. But apparently we do sometimes. And likewise for param, which has been used in, you know, embedded Flash objects, there's definitely much, you know, over 2,000 results for that. Now some of those will be dupes, because sometimes you use param many times over within the same article. But that's a problem, and it's really, really important, because it says so on the slide. But it's really, really important, and I'll give you a specific example why.
This is where we learn from history. This is the history that's been set for us to learn from.
So when Google, well, I keep saying Google AMP, it's really AMP, and it was initiated by Google. When AMP started, New Yorker was trying to get on top of that. And you can see from this, and this really isn't off the record because there's nothing crazy about these numbers, actually. We basically created an AMP template for everything, for articles and posts. And basically the blue line is things that Google was able to successfully index. And the red line is represents all the content that Google rejected. And it rejected because we didn't have structured data for everything. And this is bouncing.
Here's a quick question. How many people here are working on Google AMP or have already launched it?
Okay, so you know the pains. So one of the great things with WordPress is that you have shortcodes. And shortcodes allows for structured data. So you can represent images, galleries, all these other things. And then when you publish to different formats, it can say, here's the core parts of the slideshow. It can take the images, it can do a new representation for that. But a lot of the time, and this is really a workflow and a technical problem, we cheat and we put in, like WordPress deals a lot with HTML, we copy and paste HTML into it. We copy and paste proprietary languages of sorts into it. So iframes, for example, because, hey, that's the only way to embed it, or you don't have the shortcode in WordPress, and this is kind of WordPress specific, but it's relevant to a lot of CMSs. You don't have the proper shortcode available, so you just copy and paste, you know, the weird obscure video service embed code in. And that gets you, that allows you to have this work on the web, and that's great. But you're shooting yourself in the foot going forward. But going beyond that too, like there's div tags, images, like even image tags. If you can't properly identify images within your article and give, you know, the AMP image version that Google has been expecting, it's prohibited. And it's a hit. So we're not getting any extra value for all those in red. With retrofitting, though, of course, there is the option that you find patterns in what you're doing, and by making one correction, hey, you get half of these resolved. It's the individual ones which are really laborsome. I like, because if I go through this list of things that it's complaining about, you can see we have AMP versions of articles from 1939 and before that. Again, this is because these are being rejected because they probably don't have any actual featured images associated to them, which AMP is expecting. So again, like what's the trade-off in going in to manually fix that versus what can you get programmatically as like low-hanging fruit? It's kind of a difficult one.
Before we move on from AMP, I think this is actually a pretty interesting tangent. What kind of compromises is everyone making to format their content for AMP, or has anyone found that it generally just works? Plugin or third-party service, something like that.
By the way, this is kind of like a private joke of sorts. It's basically, if you have HTML and you try and parse it out, you know, it's going to kind of be a terrible, terrible mishmash. This is an answer that was posted to Stack Overflow to someone asking how to parse HTML, and you know, it just kind of like goes crazy. Basically, you know, part of the big problem is like, let's say you have 10,000 articles. And you know that there's HTML in there. And you say, oh, I can parse it out. It's just links and images and divs and stuff like that. And that's great. You have something that goes and runs. But what if, you know, 100 articles get messed up as a result? In order to know that, you have to go into all 10,000 articles, or someone has to, and manually check that. Or you know, so there's always a question mark even over the data that you fix until you go through the laborious practice of actually verification.
There are other ways, though.
Yes.
Now, for AMP, what we did is we have an API pumping out our content, so on record. Do you get a rehabilitation?
Yeah, not really.
I'm just saying. It's a lot less work than having people come in and check it by hand, but I don't have to check it by hand. Okay, last thing on refitting. We redesigned our website recently. Before, it was a Django app that rendered everything on the server side and then returned HTML to a browser. Now, we decided to really make it hard on ourselves and make an API and have a front end with React and have a separate front end server that does all the rendering and a separate API server that pumps out all the data. I don't know why. It seemed great at the time. but I mean, you know, upside to doing all this aside, the retrofitting that we had to do for this is we had to go back, we had to make a few decisions about how we're going to reformat the data. We had to invent a brand new schema, you know, for pumping out our data. It couldn't just be like a Python dictionary that we passed to the template rendering engine. Now we have like a public schema that people might tie into. There are Chrome extensions coming out that people get angry if we tweak or break. That's their problem.
And blockers.
Yeah, but I mean, there were a lot more design decisions coming into this than I think we really realized. I mean, taking 20 years of content, which is nowhere near the size of some of these other archives, and then pumping them out via, you know, via archives, and that's character encoding and new image sizes and how do you map all the images and things like that. And this is kind of feeding into the next section. This is where we had to learn, once we did that, once we added genres, once we added a bunch of like auxiliary data, how do we set ourselves up to never have to do that again, because that was horrible.
And the reason why is because we use AMP as one example, but there's plenty of others. So anything going forward that you are working on, you will not know in 20 years what people will be using, whether, you know, the article as an atomic unit of content will be dead and it's all somewhere more akin to Snapchat, or whether, and even so, like what will be using our content, how will it be using our content, or will it just be irrelevant? But a lot of the problems that you are going back to fix now are things that, well, they did things differently in the workflow at that point. Every time they dealt with one piece of it, if they include this as part of the production, we would avoid a lot of the issues. And sometimes it was using just markup, and I know some people use markdown as well. If you're kind of going outside the model of just text and basic styles, you really need structured content. The website is, I wouldn't say the website is dead, I think that's a bit the alarmist, but as publishers, what the website represented a few years ago versus what it does now, it's entirely and radically changed. And some of that was our fault in terms on the business side, what ads and user experience and what we had control over, so we kind of did it a certain way. And then you have Facebook will come along and kind of give you this really great user experience if you use our template, and you'll have this really huge reach. And now we're seeing that it's more, you know, we're more dependent on the platforms more than ever. So the sooner we can get our house in order in terms of like everything that we've written needs to have like a longer shelf life than, you know, I mean, different organizations will be different, but if you're, let's say, breaking news, which New Yorker is not breaking news, but if you're a breaking news site, you know, an article gets published, then that day and probably the next one or two days are probably where it's going to get the majority of its traffic for quite a while, and then it's this kind of long tail. And so as we go forward, like, we're amassing perpetual, you know, these huge, like, repositories of knowledge, historical context, cultural reference, even like just noticing patterns in terms of like, you know, I won't get into politics, but people, you know, talk about Trump, they also talk about Goldwater. Was it Goldwater? I'm an Irish person, became American, so I'm still working on my US history. But basically, like, there are patterns that are emerging which I think are important for the larger conversation that happens in journalism. And those things are going to get missed if that data, if that content is not actually in a format that people can actually access. So, you know, we have these growing list of things. So if you have HTML and you need to turn it to JSON or RSS or any of the others, those things are going to fail. You're going to have a lot of content that you will just not make it out. I could go on about that for another 10 minutes.
I think you're totally right, though. I think the website isn't necessarily dead. It's just one more outlet.
This is his favorite part.
Not on the slide. Okay, so let's talk about future-proofing mechanics, which is where we try and learn from the mistakes that we have made. Cool. Okay, really broad question here. This is something that I think please shout it out. We can get your attention.
Yeah, this is actually a problem that plagues us, and from our conversations earlier, specifically Pitchfork in more cases than the New Yorker. But
yeah, sometimes. How do you reconcile offsite content with all of your static content, everything you put on Snapchat that doesn't have a URL, Facebook live stream? How are you keeping this in your archives? What's the strategy here? It just disappears. You know, some of the stuff has a timer on it. Some of it just isn't accessible anymore. It gets pushed down. You can't necessarily resurface it or resurface it for free.
But is anyone actually scraping content that they put on other sites? Like, if you do a Facebook Live video, do you actually have a copy of that video? You?
Now, when you do successfully archive something, are you then putting it back out through the website or any other outlets, or is this just for internal storage only?
I think the main BuzzFeed news philosophy is like re-syndicate old things on old platforms all the time. And so the idea of this is to at least let us keep track of where things happen and then where they kind of republish to. One of the things that we do a lot, and I'm sitting next to a lot of people who are responsible for this, is if something was originally a post, it might become a video, or something's a video, it might become something else.
Now, when you're bringing that back in, obviously you're doing something more than just storing the file somewhere. Are you also spidering out, bringing in traffic from anywhere you can get it? You know,
yes.
Facebook analytics, okay, great. Do those sit side by side? Are you then?
On a good day.
Outstanding. Cool. Thank you. Anybody else?
This is a cautionary tale, I guess. So I used to work for the Toronto Star, and I discovered one day. In the early 90s, they launched a service called Starphone, which was a phone number that you would dial, and it would give you information. And initially, it was like, they would print it on like A2, like call this number for, you know, and so they started like news and sports, and it got really popular, and millions of people were calling it, and so they had like they had literally hundreds of these phone lines, and you could call a line to like learn about like cat or kitten care, like ultra niche, like
peanut. Do you still have this phone number?
Well, so what happened is, because I had never heard about this, and so I went back to our archives, like, millions of people were calling this, and none of it was ever archived, right? They never took recordings of it, and then they eventually shuttered it in, like, the late 90s when, like, it began to tail off, and they sold off all the equipment, and there was no record of it at all, right? And I talked to librarians, and they called former employees, and, like, it doesn't exist. It was totally mothballed, and I find that fascinating, that, like, this is, like, a pre-internet, but, like, I see a lot of parallels in that, you know, millions of people interacted with this. There was a ton of content produced, and you can find no record of it anywhere, you know, other than buried in a newspaper archive, an acknowledgement that this existed. And I just find that dark and fascinating.
We had one of those, too.
At which paper?
The Oregonian. It was gone before I got there, but I don't think there's any archives. We call, I mean, a lot of newspapers had them. You call up, what's the weather,
like, is that what Snapchat's going to be 20 years from now?
Maybe.
Just
and
this
I,
like, thing that, like,
thank you for saying that. I think it's also because I believe in our situation, it was almost like a third party. It was an affiliated company. It was like another advanced company, but it wasn't part of the newspaper and who was running it. And I think that sort of, when you have big companies like that, that's sort of like hands off.
Yeah. Personally, I think it's inevitable. A lot of stuff will just be wiped off the face of the earth and never seen again. Like, the last factory to make VCRs just stopped, for example.
Right.
Right? So I don't know if you're hoarding tapes from the 80s, but the clock is ticking. I think the New York Times still has the crossword puzzle phone thing they used to do. That's the only one I think that might still be active.
Yeah, there's several other problems too. Addressed. Some of these are a little more nitty-gritty than others. Character encoding was something we hit big time at Pitchfork a couple of different times. That everyone laughs at the old, like, Unicode decode error from Django or other problems like that. But frankly, character encoding is something that is a little opaque to try and learn when you're a very rushed developer. You have a database, you assume the database is going to store the text can you
print copies and paste from Microsoft Word?
And oh yeah, and all hope breaks loose. Yeah, and suddenly you have like 10 editors like, oh, it's yellow, the screen is yellow. And you're like, oh god, not Unicode, just go there. And it is. So, I mean, in our case, migrating from MySQL, which is a joy to work with in terms of character encoding, to Postgres, which just kind of implicitly does UTF-8 for you by default, which is a sensible default, really solved a lot. But pasting from Word is an enterprise feature in most text editors, you know? So many different platforms that have so many different text formats, and no one's really thinking about this. Kudos to the person who figures this out. Proper taxonomical classification is where we get preachy. That's pretty much it. One of the best things that we ever did for ourselves was separating artists, genres, labels, tracks, and albums out as individual entities, having separate data models for each, and then associating it back to our content. I mean, that was night and day for the website in terms of the functionality that can happen. I mentioned this earlier, there were a lot of sites at the time that we knew roughly our size or smaller that had never even like thought of that. I'm sure everyone here at the major publications has fantastic access to like professional military grade taxonomies and things like that. But
I think that's a resounding yes.
Yeah, I think so.
One of the most influential things about Pitchfork is the numerical score.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if that, like in the biz, you know, is that actually just a number, or is there anything more complicated happening, like archiving previous scores if they've changed over the years?
I can't tell you that. No, I'm on the record.
What was the question?
Did everyone hear the question?
No.
It's asking how we're storing the scores in the database. It is JS, just a flow field. Yeah. That's all. We do like revision tracking for everything, so every time someone changes the score before it's published, or you know, if you tinker with something after it's published, that's how we keep people honest. But I can completely assure everyone we've never changed the score without having something inside afterwards.
One thing I'd like to stress before we move on from this slide is that a lot of the problems that I'm really complaining about with archives are actually preventable really on a workflow level if you're aware of them. From tagging perspective, for example, just doing consistent tagging, we found that with a lot of writers and producers and editors, there's a lot of pressure to get things up and quickly. Like some people are, depending on the organization, beholden to like a certain amount of things per day or per week. So it's almost like, you know, moderating comments, you know, like you do one thing and then I have to do these five other things. But tagging is probably the most worthwhile because there and then at that particular moment in time, everything is fresh, you're cognizant of what the core themes are, rather than someone going back and retroactively having to do that as a process. The WordPress setup that I showed you, along with a lot of other CMSs, they're geared somewhat for like using as, you know, going to the publish process. They're not very good for going back and, you know, reconciling similar tags, you know, like you know, plural and singular versions and kind of merging it back into one. It's not a good place to do that. So if you can do consistent tagging as part of the workflow, and that's really an education problem more so than a technical problem, there's definitely things that can be done on the user interface side to make that better. But that is something, if you go back to your respective organizations and that is one thing you can push on, that will pay dividends in the future. It's one of those long-term things, not necessarily the short-term. Question in the back.
It does take a village to raise a taxonomy.
Can you talk about from having experienced what it is to try to retrofit old data and going with old stories with metadata and going to the future? Is it preferable in the longer term, not knowing in the future what will come up, to do a more generalized tag or a more specific tag? And by that I mean, if every instance in our new organization, when a story involves the NYPD, we put NYPD into that story. So then when we go back in and try to find stories, fit stories in which the PD are involved, about the NYPD, a press conference where someone from the NYPD was present, and it's very non-specific to that subject. So is there best practices about overly general or overly specific or anything that you found helpful in that regard?
I don't know that I'm the best person to answer that. I would say, though, that it would depend on the kind of content that you're doing day in, day out, and you'd be a better judge of that. I would argue, yes, it should be as general and specific. Because if you avoid the general ones and be super specific, in order to know that it was NYPD, because you're like, oh, well, it's clearly about this and it's mentioned several times, in order for that to be surfaced, you'd have to go in and do like this, you know, you'd have to go in and kind of like figure out like what are the core recurring keywords, or, you know, and programmatically do that. And you'll probably get those in the end, but you still have to do that entire process. But if you can be very specific, like this is about NYPD and it mentions, you know, such and such a person. I would also argue that if you can go further than that, that when you're tagging, and this tag is, you know, has also some semblance of whether it is, I forget, like the four person, organization, business,
location.
If you can even go that granular, that in itself is huge. So if you want to find, you know, this article, yeah, it mentions Miami, but it's not about Miami, it's actually about Cuba, then that would be, you know, for a machine to go in and try and figure that out, it will probably give some score to Miami that may not actually be true. Whereas a human can make that judgment call much better. And again, it gets into things like, you know, consistent tagging, like Bill Clinton versus William Jefferson Clinton versus President Clinton. These things are all ambiguous, and while they make sense at the time, it's going to be very hard to reconcile that down the road, too.
That's true. And sometimes it is okay to have too many tags. Tags can always be removed, depending on the structure, maybe very easily. And when you maybe create a custom interface for bringing things up by a certain search, to the point that the New Yorker does, maybe if it has like that tag once, you just don't show it, you know? Maybe there are other factors as well for surfacing that kind of content that could be integrated into the search process.
We should actually power through the slides a little bit because we're going to be, we're actually really using our time.
Can you speak to the embeds one? I was curious specifically what the...
What was
the,
oh, yes.
Yeah, but do you mind if I feel this one? I feel passionate about it. We've been a lot of media. Media is kind of what we traffic in. These things go away very frequently, right? They just right out of existence. Sometimes it's a licensing pull, sometimes they just, you know, YouTube, it turns out some like third party, like a user, uploaded the video. When you have high churn for news like we do in the media world, the editorial staff is loath to go back and fix these things, even if people write in. So we might have an important article, like the first time an artist who 2 years from now becomes important, where we had a video, a song that was new at the time that they need to go back and replace. What we don't have is a reporting infrastructure that can crawl the entire site and find things out. Or like, you know, coalesce, like this video is on this page, it's also on all these other pages. We have a WordPress-like shortcode system for audio embeds, but for video, and especially like embed codes that in the heat of the moment somebody grabbed from ESPN or something like that and just paste it in, like there's no way that we have to test it right now. Moving forward, there's going to be so much content in a couple of years that is just going to be completely context-free outside of like a sentence or two, like check out this new track. Dead video, you know, that like, what do you do with that? That's just cruft that we need to get rid of. So something that we really implore for future proofing is figuring out like a real media embedding strategy, because embedding itself is just broken. That's it.
Looks like you have something else to add.
I'll have another question. Okay, so you write a story about check out this cool video, and the video doesn't exist. Should the story continue to exist?
Taking content offline is not something we really like to deal with.
No, I know, but then the story has lost its...
Well, that's subjective. Sometimes yes, but sometimes it was just a related thing, like here's more info, like it's about so-and-so dying under certain circumstances, and here's a montage of his most recent concert.
Yeah. Even if it's like commodity news, you know, something that ultimately isn't worth that much, that we just stick up because it's something that was reported to us that we then report back because our audience cares. It's something that we want to keep online. We just need, and I think a lot of people just need to figure out a way to be better about watching for dead events and figuring out like how do we future-proof that on the whole. Or do we just need to collectively say, this content no longer exists, sorry. How we value that page going forward is we would probably just deprioritize it in the rankings.
This one I'm not going to spend too much time on, but it's an important part that's often overlooked. I am pretty sure that in most content management systems, you don't actually have a field that tells you what the rights are. This is important from one respect. So, The New Yorker, for example, here I'll say off the record, we have stuff going back several decades. At the time, there were contracts which didn't even imagine that the internet existed, and we often only had the rights to publish them as part of the issue. So for us to produce them online, we can do that. But we can definitely republish them as part of collections and things like that. But there's definitely content that we have that someone's already vetted and scrubbed the XML that we cannot put on the website because we either don't know what the contract really said, or it did explicitly prohibit further, you know, reproductions beyond the beyond the magazine. And so you'll go to the page and we'll have like an actual picture of the page, and we send them off to an archive that we have a third party who helps us with. And that's a huge loss. Like, I don't want to harp on the New Yorker, but there's a lot of great work that started off there. I think I cite one example. Yeah, Truman Capote, for example. I think actually I can jump ahead to, I can't jump ahead here. I can show people at the end if they're interested. Like, we have several articles of his before he even wrote In Cold Blood, where you'll never read them online. You actually have to read an image from an archive. You can't really search that online because the OCR was unreliable or doesn't exist. And that to me is a loss. Like, I don't read a lot of literature. I'm more of a sci-fi person, but there's thousands of people to that's a real shame. And so it's not so much that you need to know exactly all the rights for everything going forward, but if you have several decades and you don't know which ones you can and can't, you know, republish or do other things with or remix, that puts a whole huge amount of really great content and history and culture into question in terms of how it's going to live, you know, the next few decades going forward. This is less of a problem for new organizations or things that only have stuff in the last 10 years, but I even remember at the New York Times, we were trying to build a kind of like a beta site, and we ran into the problem that all the images that we have that any photographer had taken could only live on NYTimes.com. Could only live within that domain. It was restricted to that domain. Not New York Times domains, but a very specific one. And that killed several initiatives.
We had sold the record. Yeah. Also, we had a similar problem. I'm just going to speed this up so we have 5 minutes-ish. Yeah. Off the record, we had another problem, too, where we did a content program with Spotify. And all of the imagery and video that we licensed for the program was specifically licensed only to the subdomain that the application lives on. That means that we cannot, and this is a great oversight that probably happens more often than you would think, cannot use the media for that program of the artists involved for the promotion of that program. So we have, licensing is actually pretty hard. People are very protective of all of that, and like trying to tap dance around it can be very tricky. We also have this problem with live streams and like videos that we made 10, 15 years ago.
And again, this is something that's completely unavoidable. I just want that question or that to be on your radar, because again, with some foresight, these could all be sidestepped.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, there's probably no objection if they were going to say, oh, NY Times domains versus a specific domain. They probably just weren't thinking it through. So if you are in those situations, worth flagging, you'll pay dividends.
Yeah, and even maybe storing something, some kind of like reference to the licensing alongside the content or the support media involved would be, it's actually a pretty big step forward. It saves you a lot of steps when something goes wrong.
I would also say that, I don't really know all of this. If somebody else knows, jump in. But I think sometimes you will assume that you have rights to something. So like Associated Press, a lot of news organizations have been, you know, using their old photos that you could get off their website. But then the Associated Press is like, no, if you're going to use this for older content, then you have to relicense it or repay it. And I don't think that that's something, I think in the past, everyone's like, well, Associated Press, it's free because we're paying for it. And, you know, as people become other organizations or people sue or litigation, as things, you know, more forward, it can change.
Oh, yeah. And like, kind of off topic, there's, I forget her name, but photographer suing Getty Images.
Yeah.
For $1 billion, because basically they're licensing photos that she took and demanding fees from people, including her, because she used one of her own photographs on her own website. And you know, but there's, you know, it sounds like Getty even has a problem like figuring out what are the true rights of some of these images.
Yeah. Cool. Let's talk about some next steps.
Okay. Well,
first one's a big one.
Yeah. So basically, if you're using HTML. Beyond like the light flavors of bold and italics or basic styling, you're probably going to encounter issues. New York Times in the last week, basically they just ported over their pages from like 2004 to 2000 and something, because I believe the database that they had it in had a lot of mixed content, a lot of freeform HTML, I should know more about this. I worked at it at the time. But you had that similar, you were having that similar issue too, where you have to go and scrape your stuff because there's a lot of HTML in there. If you want to talk more about this afterwards, we've had to tackle this specifically, but within Condé Nast and also just on the New Yorker level. We launched an app at the beginning of the year called New Yorker Today, and we had to come up with a way, like, how do you actually structure this stuff in a way that was kind of like agnostic to the platform, that you could recombine things later without having things baked in. Because let me tell you, a YouTube iframe doesn't want to play nice, or you can see half of it on the like the on the mobile screen when it was initially rendered within the app. So we had to kind of deal with that stuff quickly. But again, like if you're using div or script or style tags in your content, that is a red flag. And please, please talk to the editorial side, to the dev team. Sometimes people do that in a pinch. You'll find also weird edge cases like I'm getting the NY Times and the New Yorker totally mixed up. It's just too many New Yorks. We have poetry, and those have really weird formatting rules. I never knew this about poetry in terms of like indentation space. Like you can have a text that's left aligned, but the next thing has to be centered or has to be, and you have poets calling in and they get really, really angry sometimes in the form. But how do you deal with that? Because you know, responsive web design, that's a whole other thing. So do you have to do SVGs? Will SVGs work in whatever, you know, Google Newsstand or Facebook Instant Articles? Lots of unanswered questions, but try and stay away from, you know, really deep HTML.
As much as you want to drop the hammer on editorial for what tools you're giving them and how they're abusing them, it's something that you just gotta whittle away at. You gotta chip it away a little bit, you gotta start restricting the tags that like your text editor and your CMS can generate, and do it a little bit at a time, and then as you're doing that, start to try and give them alternatives or reason with them about why they are not allowed to do this kind of stuff.
I'm intentionally rushing you forward.
We are at time, should we wrap it up?
Actually, it's our last slide.
Okay. Well, we were hoping to talk about this, but since we're at time, maybe we'll just leave you with this thought. We would love to know what kind of tools you guys would, you know, ever want to design, build.
We're not rushing out of here, so if people want to stay and chat for
yeah, please. By all means, definitely. Yeah, we've got plenty of ideas about here, but we'd love to hear.
Actually, if I may kind of break the format a little bit, there's one thing I would just like to show people here quickly. I need to move the mouse over here. So, just one reason why this is really important to me, I've scrubbed the critical numbers here. This is, I wouldn't say this is off the record, just to cover myself a bit, though there is no real, you know, secret information here. This is like the last 3 months of the most popular articles and posts on the New Yorker. It's like the top 400. If I do a quick search for things, let's say I'm gonna do like things that were in the year 2000. God, I can't, actually, can someone tell me what the search thing in the corner? All right. /20
Oh,
yeah.
You need two more zeros.
Oh, no, but like things beginning with 20.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's a lot. So a lot of these obviously, like, you know, are pretty recent, as you'd expect. If you want to go back a little further, things that were, sorry, I probably just deleted something in this. Things within 1999. And again, this is just articles that were in the issue. Like our web content doesn't actually have years in the URL, so those are kind of being ignored. So this is even a subset of the 400. Can anyone read the number result that says 7? Okay. Think of it back. This 400. Okay. So that's things being, so that this will cover like 1977, 1954. Actually, is there anything 1954? No. But again, over a 4-month period, everything above this line.
Well, actually, I mean, that first one is 2000.
Yeah, it's 2015, which was like, this was won a Pulitzer. Over that period, that's like several million pages that generated. Everything above this line, like this Hiroshima, that was over like a million each page views, and then it kind of gets lower. You're still talking several hundred thousand words of page views. Even if I go down really further, okay, a lot of like 2013. I don't know why this is popular. Like a lot of this will surface again organically, and that's really helpful. But in terms of like if you're actively promoting this evergreen content, will it work on AMP? Will it work on Instant Articles? Will it work on Apple News? Will it work on LinkedIn if they do their own version of Instant Articles? Will it work with full content RSS or JSON that you want to give to paying subscribers? Lots of questions, lots of things to kind of figure out, lots of opportunities.
that's it. Thanks, everyone. Thank you very much.